supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
For Voices in the Family is made possible in part by the generous support of Devereaux, the nation's largest nonprofit provider of behavioral health care for children, adolescents, and adults with developmental and intellectual disabilities, behavioral disorders, and mental illness. Devereaux operates at 15 centers in 11 states throughout the country.
Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. Well, now there are millions, if not billions, dedicated annually to autism research. And we're just on the cusp of discovering new causes, hopefully new treatments. Well, what are the promising developments? And do these findings mean that families affected will be helped directly? Well, we'll find out during today's show. We'll also talk with a mother of two sons who have autism. She also mentors other parents. And we'll hear about an intervention called applied behavioral analysis that shows promises and has been very effective for many children. My guests are Drs. Michelle Rowe and David Mandel. Michelle Rose, Executive Director of the Kinney Center for Autism Education and Support at St. Joe's, and she joined us from her office up there on City Line Avenue. Michelle, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And David Mandel is here in the studio with me. He's an assistant professor of psychiatry and pediatrics at University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine, and he's Associate Director of the Center for Autism Research here at CHOP. David, welcome to the show.
Thanks. It's nice to be here.
Our phone number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. First, David, to you, we've got to talk about these numbers. The incidence seems to be skyrocketing. It was outrageous at 150, at one per 150 births. Now it's one in every 100 births. What's going on?
Well, there are a number of things that could be going on. The first thing, as has been brought up a number of times, is that the diagnostic criteria for autism have broadened considerably since it was first characterized by Leo Kanner in 1943. So we used to talk about requiring 4 out of 4 symptoms for autism, an insistence on sameness, repetitive behaviors, lack of affect. And over time, we've broadened that to include a range of behaviors. By definition, when you go to 6 out of 12 criteria or 8 out of 16 criteria, you're going to capture more people.
When did that change take place?
So the first time we see that change take place is in 1994, and then again in 2000. And with the new Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, when it comes out in 2012, we'll see even more changes.
Well, this increase from 150 to 100, nothing's changed in that time span. I mean, there's got to be something going on besides different labels, different symptoms.
Absolutely. When you look at that kind of increase in a relatively short period of time, it can be very alarming. And so you have to think about what the possible options are. One option is there's something environmental. There's a toxin that's increasing dramatically over a short period of time. And there are researchers, including researchers in Philadelphia, we're really trying to understand what's going on in terms of the role of environment in autism. A second possibility is that it used to be that autism was a diagnosis of last resort, that people would not assign the autism diagnosis until they'd gone through every other possibility. And now we find something very different. As services become available for people with autism and as awareness of autism increases in the community, we see many more children receiving the diagnosis who we would not think of from a research perspective as meeting criteria.
Michelle, I'd like you to weigh in on these numbers. What are your thoughts about it?
Well, I actually have some similar thoughts on that. You know, the big question now is what is causing this? And we're just beginning to look at some of those factors, but we're still a number of years away from identifying that. I do believe that there's something going on that has not yet been identified, and my guess is as good as anyone else's in what that could be.
You know, I spoke with my daughter Debbie on the phone last night about today's show. My grandson Sam is on the autism spectrum, and she told me about her peers, you know, her cohorts, and you know, the kind of adversity they feel. Their attitude is, this is a crisis. You know, when from 150 to 1 in 100, this is an absolute crisis, and we don't hear anything going on from our perspective. We don't hear the kind of changes we need to hear. We don't hear government reacting as though it's a crisis. Researchers, clinicians, you know, this is a crisis. And I think in part, this might explain the adversarial nature of parents and clinicians. Michelle?
We hear this from families all the time, and of course we hear the war stories about the regressive episodes and what that could be connected to. That's part of the issue. I really think that it's time for us to sit down and listen to the families about this and try to piece things together. I'm sure out there lots of different people have the pieces of the puzzle, and by bringing them together, and if I could live in Disney World, that's what I would do. Is to bring them together and try to have some of these discussions. It's just that it takes an enormous amount of time and energy to do that and a lot of funding. So if we're going to put some funding into that area in trying to connect these pieces, that may be one way to do it, but it is a huge undertaking.
Who would you bring together?
I would bring families together, political figures, scientists, pediatricians, neurodevelopmental pediatrics, all the players. Now, again, that's living in Disney World. I'm not sure that that's realistic. But given what we hear from families and also what we see in the science, there's a disconnect between those things. And as a scientist myself and as a researcher, it's hard for me not to look at those data. On the other hand, when I hear these compelling families from who have gone through these experiences, it stops. It makes me want to stop and listen. So I think that is the disconnect that's going on in the field right now.
David, do you agree that we know more than we know, and that we need to bring all these parts together to put together our knowledge?
Well, part of the challenge is probably that we often talk about autism. There are probably autisms. We're probably talking about a lot of different pathways that lead to the same kinds of behaviors. And so part of our challenge is to separate those things out. And so we probably know a lot about some kinds and not about other kinds.
What kinds are we talking about?
Well, remember, autism, we don't have any biological marker that says somebody has autism or doesn't have autism.
Yet.
All we have is behavior. And we've decided by consensus that there are three kinds of behaviors we should be focusing on: repetitive behaviors, social impairments, and communication impairments. But there are lots of kids with autism, as many, many families will tell you, who have all sorts of other challenges: anxiety, sleep problems, GI problems. And these other things that affect some kids with autism, but not all kids with autism, will probably end up telling us something about what kind of autism it is, what might have caused it, and what good treatment should be.
Well, and we can go even further, and I'll turn to you, Michelle. You know, we've got autism, we've got pervasive developmental disorder, which is what Sam was diagnosed with, and we've got Asperger's, and now, you know, I hear the phrase Aspergery, you know, that you know, some people are like a little like Asperger's, and, you know, my God, that could be applied to three-quarters of the men I know, you know, little impaired with social skills and picking up subtle cues. So how do we sort through this? How do we make a diagnosis, Michelle?
Well, just as a comment to your describing that, you know, I don't use the term autistic. I try to use people first language, but we're all a little autistic. We all have characteristics of autism. Some of us are not as social as others. Some of us have difficulty with eye contact because we're shy. Some of us have difficulty listening to others and having a conversation about someone else. So we all have these different characteristics. But that doesn't get you autism. It's the quality or the lack of quality in those kinds of interactions. So when you look at the spectrum and you look at these different diagnostic categories, it's always a judgment call from clinicians who do the diagnostics. And I don't do diagnostics myself, but there's always a judgment call. In fact, last week in one of our social skills programs, the director of programs at the Kinney Center and myself were watching a child, and he didn't quite fit the mold. He clearly had some cognitive types of issues, but he was more connected than what we typically see with someone with autism. So that's the difficulty in identifying where the child is on the spectrum. And it's not the diagnostic criteria or the category, it's the symptoms or the behaviors, as David said, that gets the child in trouble or has difficulty in interacting with other children and adults.
Hmm. If you're just tuning in, we're talking about autism today on the show, what it is, how it gets diagnosed, and we're going to be talking about what treatments are available, what new ones and what old ones. We're doing some research with. My guests are Drs. Michelle Rowe and David Mandel. Rowe is executive director of the Kinney Center out at St. Joe's University. Mandel's a professor of psychiatry and the associate director of the Center for Autism Research here at Children's Hospital. David, is there any way we know which babies are at risk for developing autism, or even which parents are at risk of producing a child on the spectrum?
So there's starting to be some exciting research in this area. We know that the reoccurrence risk in siblings, that is, if one child has autism, the potential that a second child in that family will have autism is much higher than in the general population. But it's still less than 50%. It's probably like 15%. Which is still much higher than one would expect. And we're starting to do some studies, and these studies require a tremendous research infrastructure. And I'd like to point out that I think that funding agencies have been pretty responsive to some of these issues, but those wheels turn really slowly. So the NIH has devoted about $100 million this year to autism research, and private foundations have devoted a lot more, but we don't see the results of those studies for quite a while. But with these baby SIBs, we've been recruiting these families at multiple sites across the country and following them from 6 months on to try and understand how the autism develops, since we know that the symptoms usually start to become apparent at 18 months or 2 years. And so far, there are some exciting things, but nothing diagnostic about who's going to develop autism related to the extent to which these young children make eye contact with their mothers, for example.
There's all sorts of correlational studies that I've read. Mothers with a history of depression, older fathers. You're nodding your head and smiling. I can't tell what that smile means.
One of the ways that we do these studies is through retrospective analysis. That is, we find a huge data set where there are some kids with autism in it, and then we try and look at everything we can that's in that data set. It's rare that these data sets were collected specifically to look at autism, and so we're often left with these other variables. And so there are lots of things like mother's age, father's age, although there's a debate raging right now about which is more important, mother's history of psychiatric disorders, prenatal or obstetric complications. All of these things are associated with autism, but they're not specific to autism.
Are we learning anything in this area yet about who's at more risk, other than having a sibling who's on the autism spectrum?
Well, I think the parental age one is probably the strongest finding, that advanced maternal age or paternal age increases the risk for autism.
And we don't know which parent yet.
Well, there's
or does it matter?
There's a problem in that people generally tend to marry people of the same age, or if there's a difference in age, it's usually the father who's a lot older than the mother. So these studies are a little difficult to do.
Let's talk a bit about treatment. Michelle, ideally, a child would be diagnosed before age 3 and begin interventions then. What kind of interventions are going to improve the prognosis?
Well, the one that has been most well-researched and is tried and true is applied behavior analysis. And that is a technique used in autism to help modify a child's behavior into a desirable one.
Yeah, we're going to hear about that in a minute. Our producer, Mike and Scott, did a segment on that we're going to hear about. What are there other interventions?
There are many interventions that are out there, but I caution parents in really researching these things because this is a billion-dollar industry, and people who don't necessarily have the best interests of the children have a lot to gain in terms of financial. But if they research these different schools of treatment, it's going to point to applied behavior analysis. There are some that are biomedical interventions, things like the gluten-free and casein-free diet, in which milk products or dairy products and wheat, dairy, rye, and oats are eliminated from the diet. There are vitamin therapies. There are many of these types of treatments, and if you're going to eliminate things from the diet, it may or may not work, but it's not going to hurt the child in any way. Not very likely to hurt them.
Go on.
And if there are things like chelation and other more invasive treatments, I think parents need to be very cautious about these because they have not been well documented.
I want to talk more about applied behavioral analysis that you mentioned, Michelle. It has earned the seal of the approval from many powerful advocacy organizations. Like I said, our executive producer, Mike and Scott, filed this report.
At Potential Inc. in Newtown, Pennsylvania, 3-year-old Malcolm Eel is sitting at a small table with lots of toys. When he started therapy here in January, he just grabbed the toys without saying anything, as a toddler would. Executive Director Christine Quinby is teaching him how to do more.
If he's reaching and grabbing for something, not only are we teaching him how to say that he wants that item by labeling the item, but we also teach him to keep his hands down and look at us and say clearly what he wants, and then he's able to get that item.
Based in part on B.F. Skinner's work on positive reinforcements, applied behavioral analysis breaks behaviors down into small steps, and therapists work with children on each step, often with endless repetitions. The right response is rewarded with high fives and cheers. Improving communication skills is the key to changing other behaviors that trouble children with autism, says Quinby.
In terms of how he responds to directions and how he behaves in the classroom setting, if he's able to communicate his wants and needs, he won't have a need to engage in problem behavior.
For example, Malcolm has had fewer temper tantrums since he started coming here. His mother, Camille Eel, says he follows instructions better, and talking to her son has become more interactive.
Before, we would just be walking around, and every time we saw something, we would label it. And Malcolm repeated us all the time, and we repeated Malcolm. We were just a family of repeaters instead of having conversations. But at least now, I can ask Malcolm a question. He can respond to me appropriately, and then we can move forward.
Ideally, ABA is intensive, at least 20 hours a week. Kids who receive therapy on this level and start between the ages of 2 and 3 often show dramatic improvements, as Tristram Smith, Associate Professor of Pediatrics at the University of Rochester Medical Center.
They make large gains in IQ and social development and communication skills, and often are able to be included in general education settings and keep up with their peers.
20-plus hours a week is a lot. That points to a problem with applied behavioral analysis. Many insurance plans don't cover this benefit, and paying for sessions becomes a big problem for families. Another issue is finding providers, says Dr. Geraldine Dawson, Chief Science Officer for the advocacy organization Autism Speaks.
We feel there really needs to be a bigger emphasis on training professionals in using these interventions so that people can have access to them if they have the resources.
Malcolm's ABA sessions are covered by insurance, but Camille Eel made about 20 calls before finding a spot for him and has to drive an hour each way to get to his sessions. Another issue, ABA does not work for all children. Tristram Smith at Rochester University Medical Center.
Some kids do very, very well in ABA. Other kids make slower progress, and so it would be important to be able to think about what are some other options for those kids.
Smith says research suggests that kids who do better with ABA tend to start off with better verbal and problem-solving skills. He's doing research to compare ABA to other interventions in hopes that treatments can be tailored to individual children. From the Behavioral Health Desk, I'm Mike and Scott, WHYY News.
David Mandel, you're doing a large study of ABA in Philadelphia public schools?
That's right.
What are you finding?
Well, we're finding that it's really challenging for teachers to do. They've got 8 kids in their classroom. It's usually a teacher and an assistant. Sometimes individual children may have one-to-one support. And we just heard on that piece how we're talking about 20 hours a week. And usually people conceptualize that as 20 hours of one-on-one time. That's probably not the best way to think about it, but that's how most of the interventions have been developed. And now we're asking teachers who may not have had specific training in this to implement sometimes complicated intervention strategies. We find that when they are able to do it, that we see really exciting and remarkable improvements in these children.
So this raises a big question, and Mike and Scott brought this up several times in the interview about the practicality of this. Michelle, you know, 20 hours a week plus all the expense. Now, we know in Pennsylvania, bigger insurance companies are now required to pay for this therapy, but what happens to somebody in Jersey or Delaware or anywhere else?
That's been a big struggle for families. They get a second mortgage on their home. They fight for services wherever they can with school districts. It's very, very difficult for families to maintain this level of treatment.
And when they do get it, how can they be comfortable that the person they are seeing is actually trained in these services?
That's another issue of concern. Like anything else, you have people who are very good at this and well-trained. And, you know, there's another point to this, too, and that is, and we see this in our undergraduates, some students get involved in working with children with autism, and it's in their heart. It's in their blood, and they work as hard as they can. And others, it's more of a job. So there are differences in therapists as well.
I want to ask both of you a question about this ABA and before our break. And that is, it seems logical to me that parents should be trained in it. And then they wouldn't have to schlep around and, you know, I mean, it raises other expense questions about their ability to work, but it seems logical to me. David?
Well, I think that you raise a really important point, which is that the kid spends only a part of the time in the school.
Right.
And regardless of what's happening in other therapies, a really important part of intervention for kids with autism is parent training. And there are some very good parent-mediated intervention models based on the principles of ABA. It's been really challenging, as with the other forms, to get payment for it. The other thing is, as you implied, parents have a lot of other challenges.
What models? If I'm a parent, how do I find out about those models?
So a number of them are licensed to different publishers, and you can look for them. Most of the models are not what we traditionally think of as ABA. Most of the time when people think of applied behavior analysis, they think about discrete trial training. Discrete trial training is an intervention where a child and a therapist are sitting at a table interacting with each other, and the therapist is trying usually to improve receptive and expressive language, often through flashcards and using a reinforcer that's external to the intervention. Other forms of ABA are much more incidental, engaging, like pivotal response training, for example, that look more like playing with the child, but are engaging the child and using a lot of the same principles. Those are the models that I think parents want to be thinking about.
Michelle, do you want to weigh in on this?
You're right about about families being involved in this. You know, if you have families where the child goes home at the end of the day and the child is able to engage in a lot of stimming behaviors and disconnecting, they're sort of undoing what's being done during the course of the day.
We do have to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to meet Elizabeth Lipp, who's got two sons who were on the autism spectrum, and we'll hear about what life is like for her. I also do want to mention, back to ABA, Autism Speaks is funding a pretty large study to see whether parents can learn ABA in a group setting in order to have this be able to distribute it to more people. We're talking about autism today, what some of the causes are and what some of the promising new treatments are. Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, 888-477-9499. If you are a parent of a child on the spectrum or wonder if your child is on the spectrum, give us a call. If you're looking for services or if you have found effective services, we'd love to hear from you. That's 888-477-9499. My guests are Doctors David Mandel and Michelle Rowe. Mandel is Assistant Professor of Psychiatry and Pediatrics at Penn School of Medicine. He's the Associate Director of the Center for Autism Research at Children's Hospital here in Philly. Michelle Rowe is Executive Director of the Kinney Center for Autism Education and Support here at St. Joseph University. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voice in the Family. It's right here on WHYY FM.
The Hankin Group supports WHYY and is pleased to announce Claremont Apartments, situated in Eagleview, a Chester County community. Details at 610-458-7644 or at claremontapts.com.
While they're influenced by groups like the Ronettes and the Shangri-Las, rock trio the Vivian Girls are no ordinary girl group.
Our music is neither very masculine or very feminine. It's really weird and dark, but also kind of hopeful in a weird way.
That's lead singer Cassie Ramone of the Vivian Girls, our guest this week on Sound Opinions.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
WHYY is supported by PNC Wealth Management, dedicated to helping customers achieve more by crafting personalized solutions to grow, preserve, and transfer their wealth. More information is available from John Conaway at 215-585-5438.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb. We are talking about autism today, the many dimensions of it. Our phone number is 888-477-9499. My guests are Drs. Michelle Rowe and David Mandel. Rowe is with the Executive Director of the Kinney Center for Autism Education at St. Joe's. Mandel is Associate Director of the Center for Autism Research at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. But now I want to speak with Elizabeth Lipp. She is a mother of two boys on the autism spectrum. Elizabeth, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks for inviting me. I appreciate it.
You sound a whole lot more upbeat than I expected.
No, I've been living this for so long. It's, you know, it's just part of my life. It's fine.
Tell us about your boys.
Well, my Nicholas was actually diagnosed at about the same time your Sam was. Nicholas is now 10 years old. He was diagnosed at 2.5 in August of 2002. And at that time, as I'm sure you're familiar with the feeling when you're given a diagnosis of autism, all of a sudden this future that you've planned for your child becomes this great black hole. It's
right.
Like somebody has wiped the whiteboard of your mind clear, like whatever future you saw no longer exists, which is a hard period, but you do start to see a light at the end of the tunnel. You do build new dreams for yourself. Nicholas is now in the fourth grade. He's in general education with support. He's fully integrated in his fourth grade in his home school. He rides the big school bus, so he's really come a long way. I couldn't have imagined he'd be where he is now when they made the diagnosis for him eight years ago.
Yeah, Sam is too. Sam is similar. We held him back 1 year. He's in third grade, but he's doing great. And as a matter of fact, he's doing so well, he's become my teacher. I just released a book called The Wisdom of Sam about some of the incredible things that come out of his mouth and these kids' mouths. Their take on the world is incredible.
That's the other really big gift, I think, that comes with having children on the spectrum. My Gabriel is 6.5 years old. He was diagnosed shortly before his third birthday. And
what happened to you then?
Well, here's the deal. When Nick was diagnosed, I swore up and down that I was done having kids. I would never go through this heartache again, yada, yada. 6 months to the day after Nick was diagnosed, I found out I was pregnant with Gabriel. And I cried every day of my pregnancy with him, thinking, oh, my God, I'm going to go through this again. But I was very proactive with him because once he was born, he was born into the environment of getting services in place for Nicholas. So Gabriel was very much an afterthought, not in this.
Right.
When I was pregnant with Nick, it was all about being pregnant with Nick. When I was pregnant with Gabriel, it was all about getting services in place for Nick. You know what I mean?
Right.
So when Gabriel came into the picture, I had everybody watching him like a hawk. He was part of the sibling autism study that Rebecca Landa recently published. Both of my kids were included in that study because I wanted another set of eyes watching Gabriel as he grew up.
Tell us about Gabriel's level of functioning, Elizabeth.
He's high-functioning autistic, just like his brother.
So your daily life, what's that like?
We practice this thing called real-life integration therapy, wherein I drag my kids everywhere with me because they have to learn to be a part of the world and then a part of the community. And by and large, that's been very successful because I can take them everywhere, and they're great. This isn't to say that I didn't pay up front. This isn't to say that I've had people call me out for being a bad parent because Nick was sprawled on the floor yelling and screaming at the top of his lungs because I wouldn't give him his way. But you know, over time, I've had plenty of conversations with people. Like, you know, some of them have been very long. Some of them have been, he has autism, thank you for your compassion, and move on. It's been a challenge, but we're finally at a point where I don't think our lives are really that much different from everybody else's. I wouldn't have said that 5 years ago.
Yeah, when we spoke with you before the show, you had said that early on, you said autism is isolating.
It can be, because you think you're the only one doing this. You think that this is, you're the only person this is happening to, because the experience that I come into, I've talked to a lot of families, and I've, you know, counseled a lot of families through new diagnoses, and early on, you don't want to take your child anywhere because you're afraid of a meltdown, and you're afraid of the looks, and you don't want to talk to anybody because you don't want to be judged. And I think once you get in touch with the fact that there are a lot of people out there walking in your shoes or walking in shoes like yours, it becomes a lot more liberating.
How has it affected you personally?
The first couple of years were hard because I felt like this was a judgment on my character. This is, you know, that I was paying for something that I didn't, you know, earlier on in my life. It was very depressing. And I think once I got past, you know, thinking that this was a curse, that I started thinking of it as a gift, about seeing the strengths my Nicholas had as opposed to his deficits, and starting to see things, you know, it was really a change in perspective for me. It was just seeing them differently and seeing what good they had going on and seeing the good about them that really turned me around and really made me open to receiving the gifts that come with having a child with disabilities.
Has it affected the way you see yourself, see the world?
Oh, yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And I think I'm a more compassionate person than I was. I think I'm a more forgiving person. I think I'm more willing to meet other people where they are instead of making assumptions about
you know, who they are or why they're saying what they're saying. I think I've just become more open and more accepting and less judgmental.
Hmm. There's a word for that. I think it's called serenity or well-being or one of those fancy words that everybody's looking for.
I've been told quite frequently that I'm quite nauseating in that regard. But
yeah, good for you. Be nauseating. Has this all affected your marriage?
It has. I've seen this break up a lot of marriages, and when Nick was diagnosed, this happened in the context of my husband moving from a postdoc to a research position. We were moving across state lines. I was having to set up services in a new state. We were buying our first house. In the space of 17 months, we had all of that. Then we had Gabriel. Gabriel was born, and then my husband lost his job and then found another job 10 days later. This was all in the space of 17 months, and I know that that would have broken up most marriages. But my husband is my best friend, and he's been very supportive of me and of the decisions that I've made for our family and about our boys and about their treatment. It's been difficult because we haven't always been on the same page, but I think that we're at a point where we understand each other. We talk, we're very open about how we feel, you know, about our situation on a day-to-day basis. But he really is my best friend and my best support.
Elizabeth, before you leave, I'd like you to address two constituencies.
Okay.
What would you like to say to parents of children on the spectrum?
Well, for those who are newly diagnosed, I want to tell you not to give up hope, because you never know where this is going to take you. I mean, my Nicholas was not speaking at all when he was diagnosed, and for all I knew, he was never going to speak, and now I can't shut him up. He has a lot to say, and he has a lot of great things to say, and I'm grateful that he has that voice. So for those who are just starting out on this path, just don't lose hope. Connect as much as possible. Inform yourselves as much as possible, and also trust yourself, because at the end of the day, there are going to be a lot of experts and a lot of people who will tell you what you need to do or what you should be doing. At the end of the day, you are your child's best advocate, and you know them better than anybody else.
What do you want to say to David, a researcher, and Michelle, who's a service provider? What do you want to say to them and their cohorts? What do you want researchers to do, and what do you want service providers to do going forward?
Going forward, I think the biggest gap that I found in my own experience of dealing with this and looking into services is that a lot of the doctors, a lot of the pediatricians don't seem to be on the same page. It seems to be, okay, we're going to write a script for verbal behavior /ABA/floor time. And it's just, I think it gets very confusing for parents. There's a lot of information out there. I think it becomes a factor of meeting that child where that child is and getting a feeling for what that child needs at that time. And it's really hard in a 2-hour visit to kind of figure out, okay, we've got to figure out a plan for this child. But I think to just sit down and really sort of lay out some of the options for the parents, I think that that's probably a good start.
Final question. If we could get David Mandel and his cohorts $1 billion to do whatever kind of research was needed, tell them what they should be looking at.
That's a $1 million question, because and I'm not sure I'm the right one to have that question asked to me, because my children are pretty high functioning. And I can work around their head wiring.
Well, you know what? all our phone lines are lit up, and I will bet everyone on the phone could give David and his cohort some working orders about what kind of research.
I'm sorry. I feel like a punted on that
no,
one.
That's fine. I want to thank you so much for your time and
thanks for inviting me. It was a lot of fun.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
We've got to take a short break. We've got our phone lines are filled. I promise we will get to you right after the break, and we'll talk about. I want to hear more about what both of our guests are doing in their professional lives. We are talking about autism today on Voices in the Family: diagnosis, treatment, what parents need. My guests are Doctors Michelle Rowe and David Mandel. Rowe's executive director of the Kinney Center for Autism Education and Support at St. Joe's. Mandel's an assistant professor of psychiatry and pediatrics at Penn School of Medicine. He's the associate director of the Center for Autism Research at Children's Hospital. I'm Dan Gottlieb. This is Voices in the Family right here on WHYY.
Lourdes Emergency Department at Deborah is a proud supporter of WHYY. Now open, the region's newest emergency department located at Deborah Heart and Lung Center. Operated by an experienced team from Lourdes Medical Center of Burlington County, their new location will offer both ambulance and walk-in patients with access to specialized emergency care. 1-888-LOURDES or lourdesnet.org. Celebrating the opening of the new emergency department and commitment to care for Burlington County and beyond.
Years after the fact, many people still carry the scars of being bullied.
I was shy, I was short, I wasn't particularly good at athletics. I was smart, but there are, 100 little personality quirks that you could nail down that made me a juicy target.
But does it have to be that way? What can be done to stop the bullying? We'll talk about it next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
We're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We are talking about autism and its many dimensions with Drs. Michelle Rowe and David Mandel. Michelle Rowe is Executive Director of the Kinney Center, and that's at St. Joe's. Mandel is Associate Director of the Center for Autism Research at Children's Hospital in Philadelphia. As promised, we will get right to the phones. We've got Marianne on the line. Marianne, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Dr. Dan?
Yeah, hi.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
Oh, great. Thank you for taking my call. I love your program. Dr. Dan, I'm calling today because my organization in the Company of Horses provides therapeutic riding services for people with autism, and through that program, we've seen many, many, many families and how it is really, families that live with autism. And for that reason, a group of people who are people who have discovered many alternative ways that make a difference in the lives of many people, we've put together this retreat for families living with autism that's happening. It's a camping retreat. It's happening in the Pine Barrens of New Jersey over Father's Day weekend. And I really just wanted to put that out there for your people because I know just from, my experience in my program, how this is such a family thing. And I loved what your caller just said about her recommendation for people to connect with other people. I find that our parents talking to one another is such a support and such a help.
All right, Marianne,
I
want you to say something very slowly.
Okay.
How can people find you?
My phone number.
Well, your phone number, your web page?
Yep, I'm going to give them both to you.
Okay.
609-330-2444.
Okay.
And then the website for our healing, for our retreat is a long one. It's called Retreat in the Pines for Families with Autism.org.
Okay. All right. Well, it's long, but it's simple. Retreat in the Pines for Families with Autism.org, and we will get that on our webpage. So thanks so much for your call. Michelle, I'd like you to weigh in on horseback riding for kids on the spectrum. I've heard wonderful things about it, therapeutic horseback riding. Any research that you're aware of, or you, David? Michelle?
Well, what this does is it taps into the sensory processing of children, and kids with autism often have sensory issues. Those kinds of situations can be very helpful for a certain group of kids. It may not be helpful for others. It depends on the tolerance level of the child and working with that therapist on horseback can be something that could be beneficial. It just depends on the child.
Hmm. Let's go back to the phones. We've got Nancy on the line. Nancy?
Yes, hi. Dr. Jan. I'm a grandmother of a child who we initially thought had Down syndrome, and she lived in Florida, and although she was in school, it was a usual public school with a special ed group, and very little was done, and I think the assumption was she has Down syndrome, and whatever happens, happens, and she learned a little bit of sign language. Subsequent to that, we realized, and so did her doctor, that there is autism there, and also ADHD. And I was just thinking about you, the experts you have there, and I was wondering, how does one discern between autism, Down syndrome, and ADHD?
Well, I want to piggyback on top of that. How does one discern, and does one need to discern in terms of treatment? So, Nancy, I appreciate your question. I think I'll turn to David first, and I hope one of them has some answers for you. But thanks for calling, Nancy.
So it's not uncommon for kids to have multiple conditions. For Down syndrome, there's a specific genetic test. For ADHD, autism, we don't have those. You separate them by the constellation of symptoms. It's those social impairments and repetitive behaviors that are present in autism that usually are not present in Down syndrome. But your more important question, I think, is it important to do so? And I think the answer is yes. Because as we learn specific treatments for those different kinds of impairments, that is, when you have a behavioral intervention, you're not treating the autism. You're treating things about the autism. And if social impairments, which are generally not an issue for kids with Down syndrome, are an issue for your child with Down syndrome, then probably something else is there. And those interventions designed to improve social skills are really important.
Well, Michelle, let me turn to you and argue with David through you that, you know, do we need these labels? Aren't we just treating what's wrong?
Generally, when you have a child with multiple diagnoses, you sort of treat the one that is the most profound. And in practical application of that, what that means is if the child has ADHD and also autism, if they get a diagnosis of autism, you're treating the autism. It's not uncommon for a child with autism to have ADHD because of their inattention abilities, their difficulty focusing. So they get blurred. But again, as David said, it's really about the behaviors, not the actual diagnosis. Again, those categories are sort of meaningless without those behaviors attached to the diagnosis.
Any research, I guess I'll turn to you, Michelle, any research on that you're aware of on medication? David's nodding yes. So
there have been a number of studies. Antipsychotic medications are typically the ones that are used, the SSRIs that are antidepressants. There's been some research done, and they've had some effects on various kids. But again, it's part of the big picture, part of the package. If you're medicating the child and doing ABA and doing vitamin therapy, it's important to do these in a systematic way so that you know what's actually working. Again, it's treating those symptoms, though.
David?
So neuroleptics are the medications that have the most evidence to support them. But what they do is address issues related to irritability, aggression.
What do you mean by neuroleptics?
Antipsychotic medications,
okay,
that Michelle was referring to. A lot of other medications have been tested as well with these kids. What's important to remember is that they target symptoms. And because they look like symptoms in other disorders where that medication was tested, like repetitive behaviors, we've tried OCD medications because those repetitive behaviors may look like OCD. But the cause of them, and this is why the diagnosis is important, the cause of them may be very different. and so the medications may not have effect. For parents who are considering medications, I would urge them to go to someone who has a lot of experience medicating kids with autism and to start with very low, what we sometimes refer to as subtherapeutic doses.
Michelle, I'm going to turn to you for the final question. I hate to do this to you because I need you to give the answer in about 1 minute. Could you tell us about the Kinney Center?
Well, we are a center that is primarily focused on training our undergraduate students so that they can go out and work in the schools with families. We've got summer camp programs for kids on the autism spectrum using an inclusive model. Those are ages 3 to 14. We've got social skills programs that are after school. We have kids between the ages of 3 and 21 in those programs. We've got a kids' night out, which is the third Friday of each month, in which parents can drop their child with autism off. We take care of them. We make sure that they have a great time, and the parents get to go out and have a date night.
What a wonderful program. And how do they find you?
The Kinney website is Kinney Autism. It's K-I-N-N-E-Y Autism .sju.edu. And of course, we're happy to answer questions at any time. We are a resource for families. So the main number is 610-660-2170.
Again, the number?
610-660-2170.
Well, I want to, unfortunately, we're out of time. I was telling David during a break, we've covered about 10% of my interview. We could use a few more hours. I want to thank you both so much for joining us. And on a personal level, thank you for the work that you're both doing. My guests have been Drs. Michelle Rowe and David Mandel. Rowe's Executive Director of the Kinney Center for Autism Education at St. Joe's University. Mandel is Associate Director of the Center for Autism Research at Children's Hospital in Philadelphia. We've got several upcoming autism events we'd like to mention to you. I'm going to be talking about my new book, The Wisdom of Sam, at the Free Library of Philadelphia, the main branch. That's going to be on Sunday, April 18th at 1 p.m. On Wednesday, April 21st, WHYY is going to host a screening of the film The Horse Boy, which documents a family's quest. It starts here at 7 p.m. right here at WHYY. And you can find more information on our website, whyy.org. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Al Banks. Elizabeth Perez-Luna is our executive producer for audio content. Hannah Cope is our intern. Mike and Scott's our executive producer. Voices in the Family is produced by Gita Simons and Stephanie Marudis. And me, I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. Enjoy your week, my friends.